Tuesday, August 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Thai authorities seek a suspect in Monday's Bangkok bombing. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi expresses concerns about the country's ruling party.
For a long time now, Aung San Suu Kyi has been skeptical about the commitment to democracy of the current government headed by Thein Sein.
And we look at the new hit movie, Straight Outta Compton. It's all ahead. A second explosion occurred in Thailand's capital, Bangkok, Tuesday afternoon, following a large blast late Monday in the city's center that killed at least 22 people, including several Asian tourists. Authorities say an explosive device was thrown from a bridge onto a ferry pier, but caused no casualties. An investigation is underway. Thailand's Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha said Tuesday authorities are searching for at least one suspect seen in security camera footage at the site where Monday's explosion rocked central Bangkok's commercial intersection close to the popular open-air Erawan Hindu shrine. There has been no claim of responsibility in the worst act of violence in the capital since weeks of clashes between anti-government protesters and security forces in 2010 that resulted in more than 90 deaths. Thailand's turbulent political climate over the past decade led to a military takeover last year. The country is also grappling with a low-level Islamic insurgency in three southern provinces. Matt Wheeler, the Bangkok-based representative of the International Crisis Group, tells VOA's Victor Beatty there has been little information released to the public so far.
The fact is, I don't think anyone knows with any real certainty the perpetrators or the motive of this bombing. Three possibilities really present themselves as the most likely explanations. One is a bombing that is related to the national level political conflict, which has been going on for a decade now and which has periodically been violent. The second is a bombing perpetrated by Malay Muslim militants who've been fighting a struggle for independence in Thailand's southernmost provinces for more than a decade. And the third possibility is an attack with an international dimension.
Officials indicated that the tactics used were not those of the Muslim insurgency. Is there any reason why the Muslim separatists would reach into Bangkok at this time after some decade-long struggle?
There's no immediately evident reason for that kind of escalation. Nothing presents itself as an obvious reason for them to escalate the struggle like that. That said, there have been some attacks over the last couple of years that have taken place outside of the traditional conflict zone of the four southernmost provinces of Thailand. But an attack of this scale and this nature with this target in Bangkok would be a big departure for the Malay Muslim militants.
It would also be somewhat of a departure for those involved in the political struggle in Bangkok, in which the military ousted the civilian government last year.
That's true. There has been political violence periodically as a result of that national-level conflict. And indeed, there was a bombing in February, actually a double bombing, where two small pipe bombs went off, actually not far from the site of yesterday's bombing. But those were very small devices, and they appear to have been deployed so as not to cause major casualties.
Matt, with your experience on the ground in Thailand, can you explain exactly how critical this Erawan Shrine targeting was?
It evokes a number of things. One is the recent demonstrations over the last couple of years. The pro-Thaksin Shinawat red shirts rallied there in 2010, and of course were suppressed by the army in May that year in that vicinity. More recently, protesters opposing the government of Yingluck Shinawat also rallied there. And the Erawan Shrine is considered a very potent spiritual location in Bangkok. But perhaps more significant for this attack is the fact that that intersection represents a center in Bangkok, which is a rather spread out, large city. But the Rajpasong intersection, where the Erawan Shrine is located, is something of a commercial hub, a shopping hub, and could be said to represent downtown Bangkok. Also, it's evident that a number of the casualties were Chinese nationals, and indeed the shrine has been popular with tourists from China and from Taiwan for many years. So that may be significant as well.
Matt Wheeler of the International Crisis Group. He says there remains little prospect of a return to civilian government in Thailand. In fact, he says the military government is working on a draft constitution that appears to limit the authority of elected officials. He says such actions add to the resentment felt among many Thais toward the military regime, who felt disenfranchised over the past decade. Well, the day after the blast tore through the popular shrine in the heart of Bangkok's shopping district, authorities say they have not concluded who was behind the attack, but it does not appear to be linked to the long-running Muslim separatist insurgency in the country's far south. Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok.
Thai officials say the pipe bomb attack late Monday was aimed at discrediting the military-backed government and damaging the country's economically important tourist industry. On Tuesday morning, the streets next to Monday's bombing site were closed as authorities finished gathering evidence and cleaned up. Residents and visitors were somber. Australian tourist Grace Evans from Queensland said the bombing occurred less than 2 kilometres from her hotel and has left her deeply upset.
It's just too close to home. I mean, we could have been at that shrine as far as I'm concerned.
No, we wouldn't have been.
We went past it. We could have been, because we do those kind of things. We go to temples, we do that kind of thing. I just feel in my heart there's more to come. I really do. And that's why I really, really want to go home.
The dead included at least 3 Chinese, 2 Singaporeans, 1 Philippine national and 2 Hong Kong residents, a reflection of the shrine's popularity among Asian tourists. Scores of other people were wounded. Foreign embassies have issued travel warnings, urging citizens to maintain awareness of their surroundings. The Erawan Shrine is located on one of the capital's busiest intersections, across the street from Bangkok's police headquarters. The city's 2 elevated train lines both pass above the shrine, while a steady stream of tourists and worshippers make offerings and take photos throughout the day. While Thai authorities say they have not confirmed who was behind the attack, they did not rule out a link with the country's turbulent domestic politics. The shrine's location is close to areas that have been occupied over the years by different political factions opposing the ruling government. In 2010, government opponents occupied the area for weeks until the army violently pushed them out, which led to several deaths and arson attacks on nearby shopping centres. The area was again occupied by another group of anti-government demonstrators in 2014, which led to the removal of the government led by Yingluck Shinawatra and then the military coup. For over the past year, Thailand's military government has banned protests and suspended democracy while insisting that the country is not yet ready for another election. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what has been the reaction in social media to the blast in Bangkok?
Well, it's been interesting. When you have any kind of terrorist attack or bombing like this, it kind of comes in phases. So the first phase we saw yesterday was immediately after the bombing, and actually our Steve Herman, who's our Bangkok bureau chief, was actually one of the first people to get pictures out from the bombing. He used a program called Periscope, which allows you to live stream video from your phone. So he was sending that out on Twitter. He was live tweeting. So it's kind of that first step of the initial reaction. And then you get more information coming in, people reacting. We have more information this morning about the suspects. That authorities are releasing photos of the suspects. So those are quickly spreading across social media, people sharing those pictures, hoping that that suspect will be apprehended. But then on the other hand, as you move through kind of the factual elements in social media, you also have a lot of the emotional elements. So the hashtag Pray for Bangkok has been trending, a lot of people offering their condolences to the victims, their support for the city, and people kind of band together in social media at times like this. So you have a lot of people saying, oh, I love Thailand, it's a great country, Bangkok's a beautiful city, I know that they'll recover, they're very strong. So a lot of good support and encouragement. So I expect that to continue over the next few days, kind of these two tracks, one of the emotional support and one of the investigation and the news of the event. Here in the U.S., a big trending topic this morning is the Army Ranger School. Now, this is a program to train some of the most elite forces in the U.S. Army, and it's trending because for the first time ever, 2 women are about to graduate for this school. They're going to be the first women ever to graduate. Interestingly, a lot of people pointing out on social media that even though they're graduating from this school, they can't actually serve in the special operations forces because women aren't allowed to serve in combat in the U.S. But it's a huge honor for them, and it's a huge step forward for women in the military. They said just 3% of all Army troops get through this school. So this is a huge step forward. And as these conversations, we continue to have these conversations in the U.S. about women serving in the military. This is a big step. So a lot of people congratulating them. That ceremony is on Friday, so there's sure to be more on that. Maybe some photos of the ceremony as that happens on Friday. And then finally, Facebook Notes. This is a feature that Facebook has that kind of went by the wayside because people just use their statuses to make updates and things. They're trying to revive Facebook Notes and make it more like a blog post. So they're trying to compete with a site called Medium, which has done a very good job of doing these kind of micro blogs. So Facebook, they were doing this with video, trying to compete with YouTube, putting more video up. Now they're trying to get people to do these notes and put more blog-type posts up. So the social media battle between Facebook and its competitors continues. But we'll be sure to see more on that and see how that feature rolls out if people start using it and start blogging more on Facebook.
Yeah, that battle is unending.
Yes.
Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A group of scientists have discovered a new exoplanet they say resembles a young Jupiter. Called 51 Eridani b, the gas giant is about 100 light years away, has twice the mass of Jupiter, orbits its star at a distance comparable to between Saturn and Uranus in our solar system, and is a youthful 20 million years old. By comparison, the Earth, Sun, and most other objects in our solar system are about 4.5 billion years old. The light from the exoplanet is very faint to begin with, and with its host star glowing at about 3 million times brighter, it would have been very difficult to make the discovery without some special equipment. The scientists were able to pick up on the faint planet and overcome the blinding luminosity of its star by using a specially designed device called the Gemini Planet Imager, or GPI. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at the new film, Straight Outta Compton. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi voiced concerns Tuesday about the removal of Parliament Speaker Shui Man as chairman of the country's ruling party last week. Speaking as lawmakers gathered for their final meetings before elections in November, Aung San Suu Kyi described Shui Man's purge from leading the Union Solidarity and Development Party as undemocratic. Shui Man remains in place as Speaker, but is facing a separate push by some members of Parliament that would open him to possible impeachment. Aung San Suu Kyi said Tuesday that the proposed legislation is ridiculous. She met on Monday with Shui Man, who has supported her bid to reform the country's constitution. Myanmar is scheduled to hold general elections on November 8th, the first such vote since decades of military rule ended in 2011. Sean Turnell is professor of economics at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, and an authority on Myanmar, also known as Burma. I spoke with him about Myanmar's current political situation. Does this show just increasing concerns as to what is going on in Myanmar's domestic politics?
Yes, I think it is. You know, for a long time now, Aung San Suu Kyi has been skeptical about the commitment to democracy of the current government headed by Thein Sein. And so in that sense, the removal of the speaker breached, in a sense, the government's own commitments to moving towards a more democratic system. And Suu Kyi is someone who, you know, is really concerned about the process of democracy. And his removal really breached any number of procedures to that end. So it's not at all surprising, I think, that she's come out so strongly against the government's actions or the president's actions last week, and also in support of the speaker, who, you know, has not been appropriately removed.
How should he have been? If he was to be removed, how should he have been removed properly?
Well, he's the senior officer of the parliament, and so his removal would require some sort of parliamentary action. You know, he was voted on by the parliament, and really it's only up to the parliament itself to have him removed. It would have to be a vote of the parliament. That's a well-established precedent, of course, in most countries, based on the parliamentary system. So that part is fairly clear.
Does this show that there is perhaps some sort of division going on within Myanmar's ruling party?
Yeah, it sure does. These divisions have been apparent for a long time. In a sense, what's happening now is that they're now very much in the open. And that's not surprising in itself because, of course, the elections are fast coming up on November 8th. And so what we're seeing is jockeying for position amongst the governing party.
Now, under the constitution, Aung San Suu Kyi is barred from running for president. At the moment, who is likely perhaps to be, you know, who is seen as a leading contender for that position within the opposition?
Well, that's the $64 question in a sense. And I'd have to say we don't really know. Suu Kyi herself has been very coy on this particular issue, apart from suggesting that the NLD will nominate someone. So it's all very mysterious. And I'd have to say, unusually for events in Myanmar, in which, you know, rumours are usually all around, some of them accurate, some of them inaccurate, I'd have to say that there are very little rumours on this front. So I would have to say that I don't know, and I'm not sure that anyone really does.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thanks, Sarah.
That's Sean Chernell, Professor of Economics at Macquarie University. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. There's a new hit movie in the United States, a docudrama about the rise and fall of NWA, the music group that revolutionized hip-hop and rap. The film, Straight Outta Compton, chronicles the discontent in Compton, a poor inner-city neighborhood of Los Angeles, wedged between gang violence and police abuse. It also looks at how hip-hop music expressed the black community's anger and emotions. Here's more on the film from VOA's Penelope Pulu.
Where you think you're going?
Man, I'm just trying to get home.
That's my son!
You need to get back in the house or I will ruin your night.
You ain't gotta talk to
me. In the tough black neighborhood of Compton, it often seemed like a teenager could not leave his house without getting into some kind of trouble with the police or gangsters.
You had the chance to change the situation. Would you take it?
Gary Gray's Straight Outta Compton docudrama shows how that volatile state of affairs became the seedbed of rap music in the 1980s.
Cruising down the street in my 6-4.
And so NWA, the first rap group, was born.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
The group's tough lyrics on drugs, violence, and poverty, and its visceral music took the world by storm. Filmmaker Gary Gray says he worked hard to keep the story as authentic as possible, actually filming in Compton.
This is not only history, it's American history, it's world history. And so I get a chance to put on my journalist hat and be a historian.
People are scared of you, Dez. You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want NWA? Let's give them NWA.
We put it all in the music, all our frustration and anger.
Ice Cube, now a Hollywood mogul, remembers what it was like.
Our music was like our weapon.
And that's the most powerful weapon we got.
His son, O'Shea Jackson Jr., portrays his father as a young man.
They shed light on things that people needed to know.
Speak a little truth and people lose their minds.
But their lyrics prompted harsh public reaction outside of Compton.
Your songs, they glamorize gangs and drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality.
The film focuses on NWA's rise to fame and follows it through its rifts and final breakup.
Sit tight and let us do our job.
Hey, officer, I'm sorry. What is going
Sir?
On out?
Can you stay right there, please?
But its scenes of police violence are especially hard-hitting after the recent deaths of unarmed black men, such as Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York City at the hands of police.
Well, you're wasting your time, Mr. Manager.
You gotta be kidding me.
You're wasting your time.
Really?
These clients of yours, these rappers, they look like gang members.
You can't come down here and arrest people just because of what they look like. Are you crazy? But that's police harassment.
Straight Outta Compton has attracted positive reviews for offering an authentic portrayal of NWA and for taking us back to a time when daily violence bred a different kind of music. Penelope Bulu, VOA News, Washington.
Yo, Dre.
What up?
I got something to say.
Sounds from the new hit movie Straight Outta Compton. Please look at our website at www.voanews.com, where you can see a television version of this piece and read even more about it. Well, that's our show for today. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is gravely concerned about the plight of the Rohingya population in Southeast Asia. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority population of around 1.2 million people living in Burma's Rakhine State, where they are subject to religious-based discrimination and violence and exploitative conditions, including forced labor by the Burma Army, undue restrictions on freedom of movement, and impeded access to medical care and food. They are restricted in marriage and building or maintaining religious buildings. Despite living in Burma for generations, they are made stateless by policies set by previous military regimes. Tens of thousands live in camps for internally displaced persons with little access to livelihoods, markets, food, or places of worship. They have become increasingly vulnerable to human traffickers who entice them with promises of a better life abroad. Up to an estimated 500,000 undocumented Rohingya refugees live in neighboring Cox's Bazar district in Bangladesh, and around 32,000 registered Rohingya live in the district's Kutupalong and Nayapata refugee camps, having fled military campaigns and sustained persecution in Rakhine State. The United States has consistently called on the Burmese government to improve the humanitarian situation in Rakhine State by allowing unrestricted humanitarian access to all communities in need and facilitating the voluntary return of all internally displaced Rohingya to their places of origin. President Obama voiced his concerns earlier this summer.
I think if I were Rohingya, I would want to stay where I was born. I'd want to stay in the land where my parents had lived, but I'd want to make sure that my government was protecting me and that people were treating me fairly. That's what I'd want. And that's why it's so important, I think, as part of the democratic transition, to take very seriously this issue of how the Rohingya are treated.
We must all work together to address the conditions in Rakhine State.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.